All right, Habakkuk is a book that touches your life whether you know it or not. And it's one of the books of the Old Testament which has several partners, but it is kind of overlooked in the shadow of, for example, of a Jeremiah who's contemporary to Habakkuk or to Job, much longer than Habakkuk, but it deals with the same, with at least a variety of the same sort of a problem. And I found this statement in a one-volume commentary I use quite a bit, that someone made this observation about Habakkuk. Habakkuk is full of questions and complaints, and he raises his complaints to God, and God allows him to do so and then makes use of his word. It is not wrong to wrestle intellectually with faith and to wonder or to ask questions about how things work. I read somewhere the observation one time that an unexamined faith is not worth having. Believing in God and believing in God's rule of the world is important enough that, of course, it should cause us to confront our questions about what goes on in the world. And this observation is about Habakkuk. What baffles him is the apparent discrepancy between revelation, meaning what God has made known in his word and what God has said, and experience, meaning what looks close to us, what immediately goes on in the world around us and in the lives of people or the world of people. I want you to think with me about that statement for a moment. Are there any ways in your own spiritual biography where you have had to, where you have found yourself in that? What baffles you about revelation, and revelation especially being, I am God and there's no other, the Most High God rules in the kingdom of men, or the phrase from Habakkuk, the Lord is in his holy temple, ruling, in other words. What from your experience has made you raise or confront that question at one time or another? Some of you might feel willing to say it out loud, and some of you may have private ways in which this has impacted you. I can give you some illustrations. For example, the generation or two ahead of me, world wars, the terrible destruction and the loss of life, and the way evil got power, and the way tyranny used people and wrecked people's life, the Great Depression that some went through, which made people have to confront so many different kinds of struggles. The 60s, in which a lot of the order of things was challenged and questioned, and then there were three assassinations and all of the different kinds of drug culture and so forth that developed in relation to that. And then in more recent times, one of our class members told me that her password at work is from Habakkuk 1 and verse 5, for I'm doing a work, I'm working your days, which you would not believe if told. What kinds of things cause you to confront the question of the sovereignty of God as opposed to the experience of people? Can you tell me a thing? Okay, Ron?
I think that a lot of it's our self-doubt. We don't think that we belong in that realm of God's.
All right, so So if I were to say so, it's one thing to believe that God is ruling in the world. It's another thing to see myself fitting into that picture somewhere, and that His will being done with me. Anybody else? Ruth? All right, so Ruth's, and I agree with Ruth, Satan is alive and well, and God lets him do a lot of things that she really wishes he wouldn't. And so do I. Anybody else?
The doubt we have in ourselves that God can handle.
All right, the doubt that we have in ourselves that God can handle things, or if I can add to it, David, just a little bit, is handling things. So in this book, the question of how long is this going to go on? That comes up. Anybody else? Yes.
Patience with God answering.
All right. So just the question of prayer and responses, the answers to prayers that are often hard for us to recognize immediately. Paul? Okay, so the situation of God's, if He's ruling over the world, why does my own life seem to have the challenges and problems that it has, and none of you have mentioned the illness or disease or accident or tragedy or maybe it's just me, but do the ones who have power always seem to you to be the people who deserve to have power? Are they the ones you would have put in power? No, not now. Not well. I'll stop there. We're going how far back we want to go, but anyway, the idea is familiar to all of us. The problem that Habakkuk confronts is familiar to all of us in one way or another. And it is a question that he wrestles with, which is a variety of why do so many bad things happen to good people? It's like Job. Why would a good and an upright and a righteous man have so many terrible things happen to him and endure such awful suffering for so long, and then have to question his faith in the process? Why does that go on? Or in Psalm 73, why do the wicked prosper? Varieties of that are in Psalm 37 and Psalm 49. Jeremiah, in Jeremiah chapter 12 and chapter 15, deals with some of the same questions that Habakkuk confronts in this little book. So let's think about him for a few minutes this morning. We'll just kind of introduce this book as much as we can today. So Habakkuk is the first prophet to indict God instead of Israel. The prophets typically challenge the people of Israel for their faithlessness to the covenant and try to call them back to it. Habakkuk speaks not in, well, he brings up the sin of Israel to start with, but it's more why. It's not just people's fault. God, why are you letting this go on? That's the sort of thing that comes up with him. Habakkuk is the only one of the prophets who is called a prophet in the first verse of his book. Habakkuk's name, he's simply known as Habakkuk the prophet. Notice Verse 1 of chapter 1, the oracle that Habakkuk the prophet saw. We don't know anything about this man's identity or anything about his family or anything about his background, nothing about his personal life except his own thoughts and his own struggles with this. His name means to embrace or to clasp. And one idea that I've run across is that this name fits him because he, like Jacob earlier, wrestled with God. He wrestled with God, with God's rule of the world. He wrestled with how God was doing it. He wrestled with why and how long and what for and how can this be and that kind of thing. He wrestles with God, and he is called the Job of the minor prophets sometimes because of his questioning about the problem of divine justice. If you look at chapter 1 and verse 4, the end of the verse, you'll see what the issue is here in this book. For the wicked surround the righteous, so justice goes forth perverted. The perversion of justice in a world where you have a God who is always present, all-powerful, who has all knowledge, and who is good. Why do things happen like they do? Why do the wicked prosper? Why does unrighteousness gain such standing and so forth? That's the question. And one writer says, an agony of spirit is found in this prophet, an agony of spirit at the evil which follows from the world rule of an unjust and immoral power. We'll talk about who that power is in a minute in this book. But let it right now stand for any such thing that God's people confront, and you'll see the need for this. So there's sort of the background of just the man and his problem and what is at stake here. And then a little bit about the book, and I'm not going to try to jot all of this down on the board, but just to kind of know what kind of material we're dealing with. This book is different in that it contains a dialogue, almost a debate between the prophet and God. There are five exchanges between the prophet and God. The prophet will raise his question, and God will patiently answer him. Watch for that. God never gets on to him for having the question. God never rejects his question. God never totally explains exactly how he's doing all of the things that he's doing, but he reassures the prophet. And I take it, if I have sometimes struggled with this question, this problem, then I can benefit from the encouragement that God offers to Habakkuk in response to Habakkuk's complaint. It's written in a style of complaint and answer. Complaint and answer. You guys ever worked in a situation, or maybe some of you had our families have different customs. Did you ever have a complaint box? I've never had the courage to put one up. I get more than I want otherwise. One year, this is the truth, one year I started out in January 1. I decided that every time somebody came to me with a complaint, I was going to write a thank you note to somebody for whom I was thankful, or to whom I was thankful for good things that they were doing. And I was going to try to discipline myself to look for positives in people's lives instead of faults in people's lives. And I made it to January 3rd. I quickly saw that it was going to be too big of a job. I didn't anticipate that it would be daily. You try that. My son Andy told me that that was a real good thing to do, Dad, and I never told him. I only made it to the third day. The style of complaint and answer. So Habakkuk complains to God about how he's supposed to make sense of what's happening, and his complaint gets an edge to it because he argues that it's God is letting injustice go on. In fact, the work that God, it turns out that he'll say the work that God is doing is itself unjust. He'll say, well, how can you let the unjust, the more wicked, swallow up the man that is more righteous? What kind of a work is that to be doing? How can that be appropriate? And so God always answers him first. I'm at work. I'm working at work. And second, he calls for a patient trust while he's working the work. So the real issue becomes not just why do wicked people prosper, and the real issue turns out to be, all right, what does it mean to patiently trust God or to wait for God? That's going to be the big issue. So it records, Habakkuk is valuable because it records the growth of faith through troubled doubts and then to a very beautiful confession of trust. In my opinion, the ending of the book of Habakkuk is the most beautiful conclusion to any of the Old Testament books. What a wonderful prayer, a wonderful determination is made at the end of this. So I'd like to give you three landmarks with kind of what the message of this book is and how it can be kind of grasped or understood. So, and it has to do with silence or remaining silent. Look at chapter 1 and verse 13 to start with. And I'm especially interested in one statement at the end of this verse. You being God, you who are of purer eyes than to see evil and cannot look at wrong. Notice that's trust in God's judgment, justice or confession of it. Why do you look idly at traitors and remain silent when the wicked swallows up the man more righteous than he? So let me kind of make a list of these three statements so you can see. Number one, why do you remain silent? How's he feeling when he says that, when he makes that, raises that question? How are things looking to him when he raises that question? He's very discouraged and upset about it, but it looks to him like God is not doing anything. That's the, why do you remain silent? All right, look at the end of chapter 2, the last verse of chapter 2, chapter 2, verse 20. And notice that it says, but, this is in contrast to the idols of the nations and the behavior of the wicked, but the Lord is in his holy temple, let all the earth do what? All right, let all the earth keep silence before him. Now, we sing that song sometimes in beginning of a service or something like that to kind of call things to order. But this is a statement which is made with regard to God's sovereign rule, even when it looks like he is not ruling. He is in his holy temple. When? Well, when it looks like wickedness is having its way and is prospering. And this statement is the important anchor in the book of Habakkuk. The Lord is in his holy temple when it looks to you like he is and when it doesn't look to you like he is. When you hope he is and when you're afraid he's not, the Lord's still in his holy temple. So what does it mean to keep silence before him? Habakkuk is raising his complaints and so forth.
We can't hear him if we're trying to talk.
All right, we can't hear him if we're trying to talk. That is a fact of life right there, isn't it? So, and Habakkuk was raising these questions, and God was reassuring him, keep silence here doesn't mean just don't bring your burdens or your questions to me. It means, well, the third statement says what it means, I think. So look if you will, chapter 3 now. At verse 16, after God has explained to the prophet what it is that he's doing, and it's not what the prophet wants God to be doing, but he says, I hear and my body trembles and my lips quiver at the sound. Rottenness enters into my bones. My legs tremble beneath me. In other words, this is an awesome thing that God is doing here. Yet, what? Yet I will quietly wait. And the idea is I'll wait quietly for the day of trouble to come upon people who invade us. In other words, watch what he's waiting. People are going to invade us. It's going to look like the invaders are doing God's will and that there was no hope for us. And I'm going to wait quietly while we get invaded until God deals with the invaders and then we come out on the other side. That's quite a deal. So there's the sort of the movement of the book of Habakkuk. Why do you remain silent, God? I'm in my holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before me. The day of trouble is coming, yet I'm going to quietly wait in the day of trouble for the day of trouble to come on the people who are causing our present trouble. Now that process we label with one word in the New Testament. It's patience. Or steadfastness. And the mistake we make with patience or with faith is sort of the idea that it's a passive thing where we just say I believe and then it's smooth sailing from then on. And it's hard for us to remember that this is a process of struggle where we wrestle in trying to live by faith. If you think of Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, you kind of see what I think is happening in Habakkuk's life here. Where the Lord, in prayer, you remember the agony. His soul was troubled. He was in agony. And you remember the drops of the sweat like drops of blood that went on while he prayed in the garden. So this is not simply a thoughtless, easy, shallow, sort of slogan-driven type of thing. You know, everything happens for a purpose, all that sort of thing. No, it's not that way at all. This is hard. It causes us to have to confront things that are not comfortable for us. So So what Habakkuk, why does he write then? If these are his private struggles, and if God answers him like this, he wants, he knows his countrymen, his fellow believers in God need the same reassurance, and so he writes for that reason, as to justify the ways of God to his countrymen. Habakkuk, really? Yep. It means what now? All right. It means to have the take your stand and to remain consciously committed to God under trial. That idea is I think fits this. Fits the story of this book here. Habakkuk, to be an awful struggle, it has some beautiful, beautiful phrases in it. And you'll notice them as we go along, I hope, too. My favorite ones are chapter 2, verse 14, "For the earth is filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord, will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as waters that cover the sea." I love that. Or in chapter 2 verse 20 we read, chapter 3 verse 19, "God the Lord is my strength, he makes my feet like the deer's," or like hinds' feet, some of the older versions will say, "he makes me to tread on high places." I love that. And the most famous is chapter 2 and verse 4, "the righteous shall live by his faith." And that's important enough that it's quoted three times in the New Testament, twice as Paul is explaining what it means to become a Christian, and once as the Hebrew writer is explaining how we remain Christian. So the New Testament takes the premise of this book about a situation within history and gives it a spiritual application to response to Jesus in the gospel of Christ. So I need to tell us a little bit about the occasion for this. I'm going to ask you to read something for next week in this process. So let me try to do that. Here's the occasion. You notice in chapter 1 and verse 6 that God says, "For behold, I am raising up the Chaldeans." Who are the Chaldeans? All right, the Babylonians. So he's raising, the Babylonians are ascending to power. Now it happens, we know from secular history, the dates for this. The Babylonians defeated the Assyrians, defeated Nineveh, in other words, conquered Nineveh in 612 B.C. at what's called the Battle of Carchemish. In response to that, the Egyptian Pharaoh Necho, tried to go and join league with the Assyrian to fight against the Babylonians. The Babylonians defeated them too. In the process, King Josiah went to Megiddo and tried to resist Pharaoh Necho, and he got killed too in this process. So the Babylonians were rapidly gaining and assimilating power in the time just before and just after 612 B.C. And then the Babylonians did invade Judea and attack Jerusalem in 605 B.C. for the first time. They did it two more times until they finally carried the people away, all of them, in 586 B.C. But in between then, 612 and 605, or somewhere in that area, 612, 605 B.C., this happens. The Babylonians are becoming the world power. They have not invaded Judea yet, but they're going to. Chapter 3 and verse 16 shows us that. So most likely this book is written right around the time of the fall of Nineveh, somewhere around 615, 610 BC, and that you can that can be pretty well determined, I think. It's sort of on the eve of Nebuchadnezzar's invasion and all the disaster that brought. Now that means there is a political and spiritual climate in Jerusalem and Judah itself during this time that will be very important. And we're going to need to describe it, but I'd like to ask you to do some reading for next week. Please read 2 Kings chapter 21 through 2 Kings chapter 23. And you'll see the spiritual, moral, and political background of what God is doing and why, and what Habakkuk is struggling with and why. Watch for the character of the kings who ruled just before this in Judah and what they've done to the land, what they've caused in the land. Watch for what the spiritual situation is and the lives of the people. And then it might explain a little bit about why God would allow to happen what happens. I want to mention also, we did earlier, Habakkuk is contemporary to Jeremiah. What was Jeremiah's message to Judah and Jerusalem at this same time? All right, it was repent. What did repentance mean? He got very specific about what repentance meant for them. Was Jeremiah's message popular? No. Why was it not popular? All right, he wanted them to abandon the idolatry, but his message was the Babylonians are going to come and carry you away captive, and the only way for you to live is to do what? Submit to the king of Babylon. Don't try to run somewhere else, and don't try to fight him, because I am delivering this into your land into his hand. You'll be captives for, remember how long he said? You'll be captives for 70 years, and then I'll bring you back. If you repent and submit to my declared will in this matter. He was trying to enforce the terms of the covenant. He was enforcing the terms of the covenant. And that's going on at the same time now Habakkuk is doing his work. So Habakkuk's work is a personal question about how God can be justified to let Manasseh and Ammon do what they did in Judah, and then to bring Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians to Judah. And how is he supposed to hang in there for the 70 years while all this is going on? That's what this is about. That's what it's about. Now you, in reading, think of the parallels in your life, in our land. Watch, if you watch for them, you'll see some of the things that are there. Even though we're not a people who stand in our country's not a country which stands in the same kind of covenant relationship with God that Israel did, you can still see some of the principles that will be here. So we'll next week we're going to try to look at the situation. So read 2 Kings chapters 21 through 23, and then please read Habakkuk chapter 1 verses 1 through 11. You'll be prepared for our class next time. I hope all of you have a week of melting and good health this week. Pray for our people who are missing, and pray for recovery for each one. Appreciate your attention in our class today.